listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by API. Now from the Nowcast Network Studios, here's Mike.
Hey, welcome to the Audio Nowcast. My name is Mike Rodriguez, and before we get going, let me introduce the guys. Over here, on my right, we've got Bobby Osinski. Bobby!
Hey, Mike. Hey, everybody.
How's it going, Bobby?
Yeah.
Next to him, we have Diego Seco. Diego.
Hey, Mike. How's it going?
Long time, buddy.
I know.
Welcome back.
Thanks. About to be here.
And finally, over here on my left, actually not really on the left, across the table, because he is Skyping in the one and only, the Iron Man of the Audio Nowcast, Mr. Rob, I haven't missed one yet, Arbiter.
Hey, Mike. Hey, everybody. Yes, I'll have you know I'm staying up very late here in Philadelphia. to be with you today, but it's good to be here, and my streak remains alive.
That's right. And you know what, Rob? I will never, ever try to break that streak because we try to do a one-on-one podcast.
Yeah, I heard about it.
And it was going to be a special, so it was going to be a 0.5. This is show number 125, but it was going to be 124.5 okay. Special. And I sounded great. But I was the only one that got picked up. And I'm not going to mention whose studio we're in because I'm not trying to embarrass anybody. But let's just say you should assign the mics to different tracks. That's how it works.
Nice to know those problems happen at all levels in the industry.
Absolutely.
But that will teach you to try to do a show without
me. I know. You know what? And to be honest, there was a lot of excitement because there was the new board in and stuff like that. It was a really great time, but it was just me. And you know what? It was such a good setup that there was like – the setup we use here, you know, there's all kinds of bleed on these microphones, right? But the mics that we were using over there, there was no bleed. Even though we were all in the same room, it's not even like I could use my mic and hear the other two guys that were there. You couldn't hear them at all.
Exactly. Until the very end.
it was a great setup. I was like, man, if we would have recorded on some cheap mics, it would have picked up the whole room. We would have been covered. But
you would have had a show, yeah.
I know. Hey, joining us today for show number 125 is a gentleman that I met because he actually brought some speakers over and I got to demo for him. It's the one and only Scott Esterson from Genelec.
Hello there. Good evening, gentlemen.
And
I have to also say, welcome, Scott. And I have to also point out that I just met Scott also about 20 years ago. And it's good to see you.
It's a pleasure finally meeting you. I've heard so much about you, too.
Well, I heard you were coming into town. I had to skip out of town, get to Philly quickly, but here I am.
Yeah. Scott was so gracious enough two weeks ago, as a matter of fact, to drop off some Genelecs that we're going to be getting for my room, mm-hmm. Swapping out the monitors. And we just hit it off really well, and he was just a really nice guy. And, you know, and I asked him to come on the podcast, and he said no at first. And I said, there's cash involved, and he said, okay.
Oh. No way. One more 20s do wonders. You have a cash coming out of your pockets. That's what he meant.
Oh. No, small print, give it.
No, it was really good. But I'll have to tell you guys what happened in that whole shootout, which was really cool. But anyhow, Scott is joining us here on podcast number 125. Before we get going and start talking with Scott and you know, catching up with everybody, one thing I wanted to talk about really quick was that AES that just happened. Actually, it didn't just happen. We're just not talking about it. But I wanted to mention AES for a couple reasons. But really quick, Bobby, you were at AES. I saw you there. What did you think about the show in general?
Well, AES is dying. There's fewer exhibitors, and the exhibitors that are there generally have smaller booths. So it's not the case with Genelec.
No, we actually shrunk our booth by half.
You did? It didn't seem that.
No, we did, yeah.
So that's one thing, although the day I was there, the attendance was surprisingly good, I got to say. So that was the big thing. I was also there the day before it started for all of the – that's the day I gave my presentation, which is social media for musicians and engineers. And I was shocked at how many people were there, even though there were no exhibits.
Right.
I mean, it was massively packed. Huh. So that was very cool. In terms of gear, I think the big thing was the Slate digital console. I mean, and that's the thing – in the last 5, 6, 8 years, I can't remember anything that's had as much of a buzz.
Right. And I'm gonna talk about that in a second. Mm-hmm. But did you find anything else besides that? Was that about it, or?
Well, if you would have asked me 3 days after, it would have been easier. But that's what comes to mind.
You know what?
Right,
that's you know what? That's important because it's just what sticks, what stays with you. I know you were there, Scott. What did you think of the show, really quick?
And I have a couple thoughts. First of all, the booths were all downsized tremendously. The good part of it is now, because it was almost like most of the people had all their equipment on a tabletop, so there was no hiding from people. You could really have a really in-depth conversation. That was the part I really liked about it. The lack of people as a manufacturer, one day was great, and it kept going downhill from there. I think it's a show in transition, and rather than a regional show, it should go to regional shows to me. But there's a couple good things that I liked. I always am amazed by some of the mic pres that are out there, because that's mics and mic pres are always been a fond point for me. And Millennia just killed me. I was listening to their stuff, and for my two cents, that's just one of the greatest things out there. I played with the Slate console, and that's interesting potential there. It's they're doing a lot of things real right, and the layout seemed extremely ergonomic to me. And the other one was a stupid little box that I liked it so much I bought, which was the Cloud McLifter.
What is it?
What is that here?
And basically, there's a couple things on there. One, it'll give you a lot of gain for ribbon mics. And
it's a mic pre then?
It's a mic pre, and there's also actually the two products. One is a mic pre, and the Cloud Lifter. It basically kind of is like a one-to-one transformer in there, I think. But it cleans up stuff. And it was cheap. And at that price, it was like, yes, I can use this in my arsenal.
How cheap is cheap?
They showed me some love. So
okay. Okay, so it doesn't count then. Yeah, right. Okay.
That's loving cheap.
Exactly.
Well, you know, a couple of things.
What do you think, Mike?
I'll tell you exactly what I think. AES, number one. There's a lot of value in AES. Bobby, you weren't the only one that said the comment about being surprised how many people were there for the conference and things like that. Mm-hmm. And I think that's pretty awesome. I think that's pretty cool because it shows there's a lot of value at AES listening to the different speakers and different papers and things like that. But I too, you know, heard much like you experienced, Scott, that Saturday was really big and then it kind of tapered off for there. It was really weird to hold the show then too at that time on the weekend and like that. But two things. Number one, I saw the Slate Raven, which was getting a lot of buzz. And, you know, let me just tell you, sometimes it's all hype. And this time, I think it was all hype. It really was. I went and I actually got to touch the Raven. If you guys want to know what the Slate Raven is, it's a digital console that's like a giant touchscreen, like a 55-inch monitor. And it has a touchscreen on it and also has a monitor section. And you can take your finger and you can move the fader up and down. And you can also, you know, move the pot left and right. And then you can also go into like edit mode and you can select parts of your waveform and things like that. The problem that I have is, and it's really not even Slate's fault, but it's the fact that if you're going to do touch screen and if you're going to do something like that, number one, it works off of infrared, so there's a lag, okay? And number two, you can't move stuff in fine enough increments to really go fast. And the third thing that I noticed is when you have a touch screen that emulates something in the real world, you're constantly looking at your finger to make sure you're touching the right thing because there is no feedback of like on a console. On a console, you can touch stuff because you're bumping into other things.
There's a tactile feel if you're grabbing a knob.
And so, you know, it's kind of cool. Believe me, the cool factor is what it looks like. It looks like you're sitting in front of a rocket ship. But if you're going to do a touch screen type of interface, I don't want a touch screen. I don't want it to look like something I already know. I want it to be able to use – I think one of the reasons why Apple iPad, the really good touch screen applications that are on it work so well is because it's an interface that won't – there's no equivalent in the analog world.
I agree.
You know? There's no – you can't – even something as like the lemur, right, mm-hmm. where you can have velocity tied in with your touch. And, you know, you just can't do that in the real world, but you can do that in the digital world, in the analog world. I just think the fact that when I was sitting there and you're watching him having to go through these little – this demo and how he's having to look at his finger. If you mix for picture, first of all, I'm not going to be looking at my finger every time I'm gonna be doing something. And second of all, there's no – you can't develop that feel, that connection that you get with a certain piece of gear. I was talking with Scott about this, and we were going to talk about this a little bit later, you know, on the podcast. But sometimes you develop this relationship with a piece of gear that you just know one way or another if it's working or not, whether it's monitors where you – the second you turn on your system – You hear something that you may be slight, but it's just not normal. It's just not the way it should be. It might be a little hum, a little ping, a little pop. It's that type of relationship that it's just when it turns off, it's just flat. And then when you turn it on, it's emulating something that it just takes too much effort to look at. And I think Slate is a great company. I push their plugins. Yeah. I'm a big believer in their plugins. It's really good. But, you know, sometimes you got to be who you are, you know. Sometimes you can't, you know, you're a really good plugin maker. Don't try to make that thing. Don't try to make that big board. Don't try to make the splasher unless you're really going to do something that's going to be innovative.
Are they using their summing technology inside this console?
You know what? It's like a touch screen. It's a giant
touch screen. But they have plugins for summing technology.
Yeah, they have an analog section as well that's actually fairly well thought out because it can go up to 8.1. Okay. I'm sorry, 7.1 in terms of outputs. Mm-hmm. Plus, there's also 8 monitor mixes, I believe.
And
there was all sorts of other things that were built in that were really smart. Like, for instance, there was a dock for your iPhone. Mm-hmm. There was a lots of USB and FireWire connectors, like very convenient, so you can plug a hard drive in. And so from that standpoint, it was really well thought out.
No, I totally agree. Everything about the whole monitoring section, like you were saying, mm-hmm. All that was really well thought out.
I agree with you because I have the same feeling with certain apps. I love those that are not reminding me of a traditional keyboard or something else. Because I already have a keyboard for that.
Yeah.
And when you're trying to play, you come from the actual tactile world. So you're trying to emulate that dynamic. It's not happening.
That has to be very frustrating.
It does. So those apps that presents you a new way of interacting with the software – those are, in my opinion, the most successful and also the most fun to play because you learn something new, actually.
Hey, Rob, are you hip to the Raven, the Slate Raven?
No, I completely missed AES this year and I felt bad, but I wasn't able to get there. This is news to me.
What do you think about touchscreens interfaces in general? Because it's not – the Raven's not the first one to try to do the –
But this is huge, though.
No, it is.
Is it 55? Is that what it is?
Yeah, it was a 55.
There have been other people who've tried to do it using – putting a lot of smaller displays together, and they always end up failing, or they have so far, because of exactly what Mike says. When you're using something that's representing a console of that size, you want the tactile feedback, and also you don't want to have to watch your hands. Especially if you're mixing for pictures. So that's what's killed all the predecessors.
I think you're absolutely right. But the other thing I think of is if people are already getting by without that, mixing with the mouse, then this is only one step beyond
that. You know what you would think, right? Because I'm a huge mouse mixer. You know, I don't touch – I mean I've got 16 channels and I maybe use 4 to 8 of them max, right? Mm-hmm. I'm banking up and banking down. But even with mouse mixing, number one is you don't have to you get way more fine points of just being able to adjust things really fine. The second thing about, you know, when you're mixing on the mouse too is the control that you have between the mouse, the buttons, you know, and your keyboard, it's a very tactical experience. It's not as touch, you know, because you're over here doing hitting soft keys on this end and you're doing here, doing there, and you're doing selects and you're using your right mouse button.
But you know, it was prototype, though,
right.
too.
Right. And, you know, here's the thing, though. I think we're going to be going to a touch type of world. I mean, look, everything is going that direction.
iPad, sure, yeah.
You know?
We have to. I mean, just from a, right. as a manufacturer, looking yeah. at the potential cost advantage, it's, right. it's huge.
So I'm not saying well, that – go ahead, Rob.
The thing is, though, there's also – there are haptic technologies coming out and other ways to actually do a tactile touch screen.
Right.
And I think that probably will be the real revolution in this stuff. Unless – I mean, maybe with this slate, which I haven't even seen. I right. apologize. I'm way behind here. But, I mean, is there maybe like on a fader, if you need a higher resolution, is there a button you can hit to like zoom in to get that higher resolution on a fader or knob or
you,
some of that?
I
mean,
what?
That's all just software.
That was on the slate. I did see that feature on there. Right. I don't believe it was working. You kind of talked around it.
I had heard about it. I didn't actually get to see it, but I'm thinking that's just one more step that I don't want to have to control shift zoom to use my finger. You know, here's the thing that I got off with the whole Slate Raven thing is I can see touchscreen making an inroad, but I would almost think that it would be a combination of hardware or soft hit buttons and gesture controls that won't look like your traditional mixing console. You know, maybe you slide up your hand and it's going to be something that's going to be very non-traditional looking. People are going to say, it's so simple. Why didn't
but
we think about that?
It's very hard to get something new like that adopted though.
Right.
I mean, it sort of has to look like and emulate something that especially the older professionals are used to because people are very resistant to change. It's very hard to.
It's, you're absolutely
yeah, but
right.
for example, let's say they come up with an idea about mixing your music. Let's say instead of seeing faders, you see a stage, and with your fingers you can pull up or down elements to make them more dry or wet
right.
in the mix.
That's but, the Line 6 mixer.
Exactly,
yeah.
but
yeah.
at that point you have to give up the control that you have with faders because it's presenting you a
right.
new way of mixing.
That's exactly.
Which is what I like about some of those apps because you wouldn't do those things with a hardware controller.
You know what? There's no doubt that I think if we take the if we use gaming as an example, gaming audio, where you instead of having events, you have objects, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what if you have a vocal object that if you were going to do the same thing in the real world, you'd be running compressor with a vocal leveler and then you'd have you know, some EQ going. Well, what if you set up those rules on this object here?
Like waves, like CLA.
Exactly.
Plugins, yeah.
And then say, okay, my vocal is going to stay within these parameters, and then you use a touch screen, you use some type of interface to place it. But you know, with the technology that we have and with the power of the computers, we move from such a linear form of mixing to a more nonlinear and let the computer kind of take control of the object. I see that in like in the game engine world,
mm-hmm.
where you know they don't do you know there's not a little guy doing the actual real time mixing. You
yeah,
know? It's all setting objects and parameters, and it kind of does it on its own. And that I think is where we can go with this kind of technology.
You know what else about the Slate console was, unless you see it, you don't understand about the radical angle that the touchscreen is at, and it looks very odd. And they said they brought in an ergonomic engineer that precisely set the angle. And maybe that's true in order to reach everything you need to without, you know, throwing your arm out of whack. But I would think as a speaker manufacturer, that would bother me because you're going to have a whole lot of splash off that screen. It's not going to be.
That's the monitors are my nightmare. I have to live with them because if you have to change your technology to compensate for the speakers, that it's never going to fly. I mean, monitors aren't going away. Diego, how many monitors do you have in your rig? Three? And you've got a whole bunch in yours. So we work with people all the time about putting sound deadening material on the back of their monitors to try to minimize that. But yeah,
I am your worst nightmare, Scott.
Only for 20 years.
That's true.
Wait, how many monitors do you have in your studio, Rob?
I think 12.
I can't believe it.
Yeah, it's 12.
You play like, okay, today I'm going to mix with this.
You win. 12 video monitors and 2 5-1 setup or 7-1 setups in the same room.
Of course.
It's just reflection. I mean, seriously, central.
What do you do with just one surround setup? Come on.
Well, you know, I think.
Well, when I'm talking about monitors, I'm talking about speaker monitors. Yeah. I'm not talking about video display monitors.
I thought you were talking. Well, because they're constantly fighting with each other. So I see what you're saying. But yeah, with the slate, you're basically introducing a reflective surface at a weird angle.
A big one, yes, right.
Well, but you know what? As bad as that is for the speakers, it's also. Have you ever seen anybody trying to use, like, when that arc thing was out or any of these systems that require you to lean forward? You play with it for a little while and your back goes out and your arms and your shoulders get tired. Oh. I mean, that's another problem I've seen with touchscreens.
No, that's one thing that I noticed too is, listen, the angle didn't look that bad. But for me, having to raise my hands and my arms,
all the time.
You know, it's a whole different.
And if you're doing
hours of mixing, you're going to mess with the
stuff. Yeah, and I'll be honest. You know, sometimes when I'm like on a 12-hour day or something, I'm leaning heavy.
But that's
into
why
that
they
console.
Put that leather band on console.
I am on that thing like it's propping me up. If it wasn't there, I'd be on the floor.
But maybe that's good for you. That's some good exercise. You know?
Oh my God!
It could be.
Put some weights on your wrist.
Listen. All in all, I think it was a great attempt, and they may even sell some. But I just think it's not going to. Make anything faster or better than what we have.
Well, the problem
right now.
Is they're fighting also with the traditional consoles. I mean, if the whole idea, if the whole sales point here is about the screen, engineers will ask, so what about the sound?
Oh, yeah. No, it
does, and at that point,
it doesn't make any sound. And, I mean, that's a good point, too. And the other thing also that I noticed about the whole setup in general is. The workability of having a touchscreen system, right, and then you're going to want to incorporate other things, it requires so much of your attention here that you can't – it's not going to be really convenient to make like another monitor or another smaller computer or something.
Right, right.
I mean, it just seems you're so focused on what's going here, you know? Oh, you're going to run picture. I don't know.
If you're running picture, I mean, that's a big problem because you've got to get to the queue instantaneously.
I applaud them for bringing out, for making people talk. And let me tell you, Slate, they know how to generate buzz.
Yeah,
they always know how to generate buzz. At NAMM Show last year, they put together a little console that wasn't anything more than a lot of, you know, gear that you could get other places kind of packaged together. So, you know, I worry about them because, you know, they're trying to be – they just want to be something. They just want to be that next level.
Well, see, they brought out their own speakers too. Yeah. They're Slate monitors, which was actually smart because if they would have put Genelex or something up there, then you would have had something to reference against. But with their speakers, there's nothing to reference against. Yeah. So if it sounded crappy, it could have said, well, it's the monitors.
And, you know, I didn't even get into, like, when he switched it to Pro Tools mode and when you start trying to edit sounds on that – on a touch screen where you have to find the zero node for, like, trying to do loops and stuff like that. It's like, no. So –
okay. Let's switch topic, okay? It's going.
But I just wanted to. I wanted to put my two cents in there because I really studied that. And I hate to be ripping it because like they're really pushing the envelope. But I think the envelope needs to be pushed
a
little
more. Well, you know, a good thing that you can hope out of this is that the experience they gain with this product. Can be used to develop other products that might have more sense, because they're pioneering something, so they're doing some mistakes.
Right.
But at some point, they might stumble upon something very cool that it's the right use for it.
And it's also possible, looking at the monitor world for touchscreens, that perhaps you will start to see tactile feel inside of a monitor. So if you want. A shaft being a fader, you'll feel something
that would
that
be awesome.
A little bumpy.
Yes.
Didn't you say there's something like that, Rob?
Yeah, the haptic technology. I've investigated that for Stevie a bunch of times because for the blind, it's a great thing. If you can have vibration, like a mouse pad or something that can actually have different textures to it. Mm-mm. So as you're rolling your finger over the screen, like if you hit the edge of a window, you'll feel a little bump.
Right, right.
They have screens like that. I've never seen anything big in production that you could do a whole console on, but it's a pretty cool technology because it actually, you really can then use it without looking at it.
Right.
It does give pretty good tactile feedback. I was actually going to ask about the Slate. Is it multi-touch? Like, can you have 10 fingers down doing 10 different things at the same time?
It is multi-touch. It is multi-touch.
I was watching him.
Yeah, you can definitely do that, which in some ways is cool, but in some ways, man, having to look at one finger, but can you imagine having to look at your right and left hand at the same time? And I just...
Listen,
you know what? If you dig deeper, you're going to discover that they were recently bought by Windex.
Yeah. Not to mention that the smudge and all. Yeah. I mean, it's just, I don't know. Like I said, Slate, they're really good at generating buzz, but you know, sometimes you get in the cycle of always having to be the buzz, always having to generate the buzz, and you know what's going to happen the next AES and what's going to happen the next show.
You know, just coming off from that and talking about AES for a second, the other thing that really jumped out at me is the proliferation, and this is no different than ever, but maybe it's more exaggerated than ever, the proliferation of microphone companies and microphone preamp, boutique microphone preamp companies. I can't even imagine why someone would even think that there's a market to build another one, and yet there's so many new ones there.
How about some of the little analog desks that were out there?
Yeah. And nothing less than $20,000. Too.
Oh, I know. I totally agree on that one. It's not inexpensive to be in the hardware biz.
Yeah.
You know, for my friends that do this, it's like, man.
Well, how much, just price range wise, how much is this Slate console?
They wouldn't say.
His thing was
priceless.
It's the prototype, and they don't even have any. There was only one of them, which was this one.
Right.
So they wouldn't say.
He was asked that about every 10 seconds.
Yeah,
of course. Yeah.
But you know, you look at what was that? Mackie did that Mackie digital console, that one, or was it Alesis? The DM1 was it the Alesis or was it?
Wasn't DM1 Yamaha?
No. There was one that came out a few years ago that was two screens. I think it was Mackie.
Yeah.
It was two. It came in, a lot of hype. I saw it over at RSP. They had a big thing, hey, come check it out. And then it went away.
Now they have the 1688, I think. The one that you slide the iPad in.
That's
just shipping. Yeah.
So anyhow, you know, before we go, there was something that I did I was able to check out at AES. And actually, it was a demo that was set up by our good friend Thomas Vent. He sent his friend over to demo a plugin that was phenomenal. It's called Spatial Audio Designer, and you can actually, if you Google that, you can go on the web and pull a demo on. And it's a 5-1, 7-1, 23-1, 18-1 speaker emulator for headphones. It works the best with headphones a binaural recording. And it's Spatial Designer because of the way it works and the way you can set whatever you want to emulate. And, you know, a lot of them don't work that well, but this one works really well. It gave me the illusion of audio passing over my head.
But there's another one.
Oh, I saw that guy too. Yeah.
Is it up mixing in real time?
It's
the moment you select a different.
Yeah, what it is it works with like you put a plugin on your track and then you have a master plugin here.
Right.
So you have to use their like kind of engine, but it works really, really well. I mean, it's phenomenal. You know, for me, it's, you know, everybody can do the, you know, left and right, but it's when you can get the up and down.
Right.
That's really hard to do. And then if you can get the right behind your head type of sound.
That's real hard.
That's really hard to do too.
Yeah.
And this one, no problem.
Somehow, DTS with Neo X 11.1, they're doing that for real.
Yeah.
You know, I've been working with DTS for a couple of years. And when you mix it with 11.1, you can actually put stuff behind on top.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting mixing it that way.
It's funny that you mention that. I'm an ex-DTS guy.
Right.
That being said, but the Smith brothers who made the original algorithm have an incredible 5.1 headphone out there, and they actually measure your ears before you do anything. They use, I think, Stax headphones. Hmm. And you ask about height. I mean, I heard things directly in the top of my head moving back the front. It was an amazing experience.
Yeah. So before we take our break, I want to recommend people to check out this Spatial Audio Designer plugin. It's pretty cool. It's, you know, if you were ever wanting to do a 5.1 mix and you didn't have a 5.1 system and you just kind of wanted to fake it a little bit.
I mean, so it's not just for headphones?
Well, it works the best with headphones. And that's all I heard it on. That's how they were doing it. But it's really – it's a cool plugin.
Well, definitely. There's no way to demo that kind of stuff at trade shows anyway.
Yeah.
And who was that by again? What was the name of the company?
The name of the company is – hold on. I'll tell you right now. I have it right. It's Spatial Audio Designer.
Okay.
And the name of the company is – it's a German company. You know, I don't know.
Should say a joke right here in this specific break. Rob, do you have one?
but yeah, because if you just go to – it's headphonesurround.de. But just check it out. I mean, just if you check it out and just demo it, then you'll see what I mean. But it works. It works really well. Well, we're going to take a break.
Well, I will also say, because it's probably the quickest, easiest way to reach them, by the time this podcast posts, I'm going to need to check that software out. So, Thomas, shoot me an email, please. We got to talk about it.
All right. So we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk to Scott more about some Genelecs. I'm going to tell you about my shootout that I had with their monitors, and we'll talk to Diego and tell you what he's been up to. So we'll see you on the other side.
You're listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by API and Westwave Audio. Have a question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the LA area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com.
Welcome back to the Audio Nowcast, and before the break, I was crucifying Slate Digital.
Totally.
And I am a real big fan of the company, so I'm not like...
So why did you do that?
No. I gotta tell it like I see
it's
it.
It's out of love.
I gotta tell it like I see it. That's all I can say, you know? And we'll never have Slate on the podcast. But anyhow.
They're gonna come with a pitchfork. Just raving case.
Oh, man. Anyway, so Scott's here with us from Genelec. And I don't know if if you're listening to this podcast. Well, tell us a little bit about Genelec, Scott.
Genelec's an interesting company. It's a Finnish company. We are about 180 miles south of the Arctic Circle, about 90 miles from Russia. And they started out doing some projects for the Finnish Broadcast Company. They are the first professional powered loudspeaker manufacturer. They've been doing that now for 30 years. And that's all we make are professional speakers. We have some for in-home for home theaters, commercial installations, and our real strength is the recording studio business. And now we've gone into where I was demoing to you speakers with DSP to optimize a speaker for a room. Unlike a concert, which is a really big place, you know, might be 5,000 seats, 8,000 seats, getting a small room to sound good and flat is a lot tougher than one would think, as you guys well know.
Of course.
Well,
ask Rob. Don't ask him.
Yeah, Rob, you need a third 5.1 system.
No, we're good. I'm not even there.
Well, my experience with Genelec was back in the day, a long time ago. This is back in the 90s. I was working with some Meyer HD1s. I don't know if you guys remember those.
Oh, yes. Used them for a long time.
And those were the first powered monitors that I had ever heard and used. And they weren't inexpensive. They're like $5,000 a pair. They're really expensive.
Oh, I think they're $5,000 a piece.
Was it a piece?
I think so.
I, they were just
they were expensive at their time.
They were really expensive.
They were great speakers.
And, no, they were really good, but they were really expensive. And I they weren't my speakers. I was actually working with Teddy Riley at the time, and they were his speakers that we were using. Trying to use it on a live rig, and we had them set up as monitors for the live rig because I had this. That was back in the days where you had huge MIDI setups. I mean, this setup was like the equivalent of 4 32 space racks with tables that came out, and then modules and and modules and so we were using these because you know half the thing back then too is it has to look good.
Exactly,
right? It has to. You got to have a little bit of. You know, just a little bit of bling there. So when Teddy brings all his friends that come to visit, he can see his setup. And so having HD1s was not a bad thing to have them there. But the first problem that I came across is as soon as the PA was turned on, I couldn't hear diddly on those HD1s. It literally, the PA overpowered my monitoring. I mean, you couldn't even tell that they were on because the PA, because we were right off stage, you know, right
off the side. They had limiters in them too.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, you can't push them exactly because then they stop.
They just stopped. Yeah.
So I ended up having these HD1s that I would set up for the tour. But
on your shoulders?
No, I'd have headphones. During the show, I'd be on headphones. So I'd have these, you know, $5,000 speakers, and I'm over here monitoring the whole show on like, you know, Sony cans. But I really, you know, when the PA was off, it was really cool. They sounded great, but they were really expensive. And then I went to NAMM that year, and that's when I was introduced to Genelex, and I heard the Genelex, which were less expensive. They still weren't cheap, but they were less expensive. And to me, they sounded really, really good. I mean, actually, I think they sounded a little better. I thought the HD1s on the high end could be a little frail. You know, I don't know if you
that was the weak part. I thought,
yeah. But the Genelex, they sounded better. They sound a little bit more aggressive, like they could kind of take it and you could really kind of hit it.
Weren't they the first monitors with DSP as well?
The
HD1s.
I don't know.
I think so.
I don't
know.
They
were. Yeah, they're way back when. Yeah. Anyway.
Because I stopped using them after I blew one out, but that's a whole nother story.
Right.
So you like the Genelex?
Don't tell Teddy.
I was going to say, was this really?
I just packed it in the case and that was it. But anyhow, but then I liked the Genelex and I was like, oh, I'd like to do the Genelex, you know. Well, I didn't get them at that time, and you know, years later, and I'm working in a studio and we're changing out their KRKs and we're going for the Genelex, and I got some Genelex 1032s in, and then I mixed on those for about 8 years and I loved them. And then I went to the place where I'm mixing now, and they have an M&K system, which was okay.
It's a 5-1 system? Or
it's a 5-1.
5-1, yeah. Okay.
The problem with M&K is, well, first of all, they're no longer around, M&K. Now it's MK Sound.
Yeah.
And the second thing is it's really – they're kind of a speaker that was kind of manufactured and presented kind of with a – film type of home theater type of
and it's also built around the subwoofer. The subwoofer is the big thing for M&K, and the satellites are almost like I shouldn't say an afterthought, but the sub is the big thing.
No, because it's so funny because, you know, that was one of the things I noticed right off the bat. So anyhow, it's time to replace my speakers, and I meet the Genelec guys over at the AAS show, and we set up a demo through Troy Morris, and Scott comes over and he drops off 5-1 system for me to demo.
Which ones?
Over Trailer Park.
We brought over 3 8250s. It's an 8-inch woofer, 1-inch tweeter. The surrounds were 2 8240s, 6.5 woofer, 3/4-inch tweeter, and a 7270 subwoofer with a single 12.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me tell
that
you.
That should do it.
Right off the bat, exactly what you said. It was like when I plugged it in, first of all, what Scott did was he used the DSP and he swept the room and he made corrections. The speaker made corrections. It's not a gimmick. It works really, really well, especially my room, which is not the most acoustically sound place. Mm. And it worked really, really good.
Well, you do it multiple places, right?
It depends on what you want. You can either do a single point, which is what we did, or you can do a multi-point where you can really shape, you can control the size of your optimized listening position.
Oh, okay.
So what Scott did was he says, where do you want to sit? And I said, okay, I sit right here. And he held the microphone up and he did all the tones, and it kind of was set and forget. It was like, if you have the software and the speakers and everything, I'm not trying to say you're not a smart man, Scott, but but it really, you know, he hits the little buttons and it kind of does its thing. And at the end, it's a really good sounding sweet spot. And the cool thing was he was saying that you can make different sweet spots. So you can do a sweet spot for the client.
For the users in the back.
That's behind. Yeah. And you can do it, you know, if he's off center or whatever.
Were you feeding him digitally or analog?
I was doing all digital. It was all digital. It was coming out.
That really helps too.
AES.
Oh, it was great. Yeah.
Yeah. And so we set it up. And the first thing I noticed right off the bat was the Genelex filled in a lot of gaps that I really – I had suspected that – that there were there, but absolutely the you know, the MKs, you know, you have your sub, and then you have your highs, you know, and a little bit about the high mids, but the like the low mids, and even, you know, that, you know, low mids, there's a lot of information in the mids that that people tend to like just to throw away. And when you mix, what started this whole thing is I was doing some spots using the new CallMax specs, which are very specific as to how your level is and basically what your spot's going to sound like, because the curve that they use, the weighting to get to your level is very specific, right? And everybody's going to have to play by the same rules. Well, my TV mixes were not translating onto TV. And I'm like, why doesn't it sound the same? And then I bring in this, and I've always suspected my speakers, right? I bring in Scott. Man, he shows me exactly what I was missing. I was like, holy smokes.
The first thing when I went in there, you said, okay, what's the deal with the DSP? and you've given me the look.
Like, it was, yeah, and it was pretty amazing, you know. And I, you know, I'm no slouch. I've been mixing for, you know, almost 20 years, and but it's the fine details that you really
miss.
Well,
we do a couple things different. Rather than just doing EQ, I mean, each speaker, depending on what you're doing, has either four or six bands of parametric EQ. It's cut only.
It's each speaker then.
Has four to six. Depending, if it's a three-way, you'll have six bands of parametric EQ. A two-way, you'll have four bands of parametric EQ. And it's cut only. So if you have a standing wave at, let's say, 80 hertz, you don't want to be filling in 15 dB there. Yeah. When you go then to Diego's facility, which is fine, you're going to lunch your woofer. So it's cut only to take care of that. But the other thing, which to me is even more critical, we delay everything for time of flight, which means all the speakers arrive at the listening position at the same time. We don't go to a millisecond. A foot is a millisecond. We go to a microsecond,
right.
Which is a centimeter.
Right.
So your image gets very wide.
Which, I'm going to interrupt you for a second. What I noticed was a very focused sound.
Yeah, of course. If the phase, it's
there,
no, obviously. It feels
no phase. I mean, it was very focused. Yeah. And it was a joy. It was a pleasure, really, to mix on the system. And I brought in all the people that I needed to go. It was not a hard sell. I said, look, this is what I mix on now. And this is what I need to be mixing on.
Right.
And it was really – it was night and day. But it really showed that, you know, as much as you – you know, I consider myself a pretty good mixer. You know, I've won some awards and things like that. And it's still amazing how you can, A – you know, when you get, I felt like I was just shown a new way just by getting monitors that, you know, it's not like the M&K suck. It's not like I'm mixing on, you know, just two little headphones that are pointed at you. You know, I mean, they're pretty decent speakers, but when you get some really good gear, it's just amazing how it's just inspiring just to, you want to do your job, you want to mix, because now you can hear things and you can do stuff. And if there was ever a reason to invest money in good monitors, it was if you could ever demo a good monitor in your listening environment and you just go to where you were at, to where you will be, you'll just, it's inspiring. That's about the best thing I can say. It really was. The second thing I want to say about Genelex is I mixed on the 1032s and I had the 8050s. And, you know, you get a lot, and I'm sure you hear this, that a lot of people are in love with the old 1032s.
Actually, I like the new ones better. I came from the 1031.
Yes.
And I bought the 8040.
Yes.
And there's a big difference. I mean, the 8040 are brighter. They're sharper.
To me, the bottom is much more focused.
Yeah, I mean, you can tell the difference. I like it better. But I heard the same thing,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, I'm like, listen, guys, you know, I'm all for the holding on to, you know, what you like and stuff. But sometimes when technology, you know, takes the next step, it's not a bad thing. And
yeah.
I was.
I did the switch in the same room. I was using 1030 and then 1031, and then I got the surround system. And it was like, oh, wow.
Yeah.
It was really brighter. I mean, I liked it. I didn't feel like, oh, I'm missing out something.
Well, part of that is because of the waveguide. Rather, on the older one, you had equal power going up, down, left, and right. But in a studio, there's two types of sounds. There's direct sound, there's indirect sound. And you want to have direct sound rather than reflections off the ceiling or the wall. So we're focusing the high energy more at you. And as a result, that's part of the apparent brightness on it.
Right.
We do go out a little a little more on the top frequencies.
Right, right.
But it's a lot smoother. It really is.
Yeah.
It's not as hashy as – I mean, I work for Genelec. The 1032s, I roll off the top a couple dB just to make it
– I think I did the same when I was using them. But anyway, it might be one of those
But you know what? I'd rather have that option to roll it off and to still have, you know – smooth from the top down, as opposed to sometimes when you roll off on some speakers, you roll off the high end and you lose so much.
Right.
You know? You lose a lot of definition. I mean, I'm going to name names here because that's what I do. I mixed on some KRKs that were just bright as it's not just and they were they, and you tried to EQ off the top end, but if you EQ that, then you have none. I mean, that's where it was. It was all up in that. And that
sweet
high end,
right? Was,
yeah, I'm not. Yeah, that's just me. I'm not a huge KRK fan, but anyway. But we don't have to worry about that anymore, do we?
Right.
We're not going to be pissing anybody off there. Anyhow, Rob over there, what kind of monitors do you have? What are you working on? What are you mixing on?
I go back and forth because I have a 5-1 setup with 1031s, I guess. That I totally love and that we use for most things. I do have the newer generation 2, which is 8040s or 8050s.
The 40s are the smaller, 50s are the replacement for the 31s.
I just lost Scott. What'd you say?
The 8040 is a 6.5, and the 8050 is the replacement for the 1031.
Okay, so I have the 8050s and the 1031s. And I tend to use the 8050s more in my face, like at my sequencing station. But when we mix and surround, we still mix on the older ones. We're very used to it, and we've had great success with the stuff translating. And it's one of those, if it ain't broke, don't fix it things. Because we've mixed hundreds and hundreds of projects on them, and we just know the sound intimately. So I go back and forth between the two. They're all really good. One thing I'll say about Genelecs, and most speakers, but Genelecs in particular, because they are so accurate, you got to make sure they're set up right in your room. If you just get them out of the box and throw them on a table, they're not, in my experience, going to be the most pleasing speaker right out of the box. But if they're set up right, they're by far my favorite.
Well, again, in a small room, placement is really critical.
Right.
You know, depending where it is in relation to a wall, the rear, a quarter wave in the back, you're absolutely right. I mean, one thing I keep telling many of my clients, if a meter bridge was a good place to put a speaker, shouldn't it be called a speaker bridge? Because it's not a good place for most people.
Right.
Well, you know, having said that, Genelec makes a really good app. It's like $2 where you can do your speaker placements that Scott used.
I saw it.
It works really good. I mean, I have it here if you guys want to take a look at it.
Yeah, I do.
But it's pretty simple. It's pretty quick and easy. You just point to the speaker.
You know, when I started using Genelecs at the time, a lot of friends of mine were using Yamaha NS10 because they were doing a lot of dance music. That was, you know, the period of my life into dance music.
Right, sure.
But I was working in a studio that had Genelecs, and I bought the NS10 too because it was just part of getting the same speakers. But then when I had the money, I switched to Genelec, and I was like, oh, now I can actually hear the basses instead of knowing that there is a bass there. Because that's the thing with this producer. They mix with the NS10 and they say, no, I know the speakers.
Yeah.
Well, I think you know what you think you know because you can't really hear stuff.
Right.
And so at some point you get used by a combination of reading the frequency analyzer and the speakers. And you find your way around, but then at the end of the day, you always go in the car to check if the mix is right.
Yeah.
You can't really tell.
I love those guys that they can calculate the amount of bass they have by how far the subwoofer is.
Yes, especially with the NS10. That was the whole
the
point.
NS10, right.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's something to be said about working and mixing on like NS10s or even the bookshelf monitors, because I like the BX5As. I think that's one of the best small little
what is it?
M-Audio BX5As.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Just the little one that you see all over the place. It just, to me, it's such a great like first pair of speakers. If you don't have a lot of money and you just want to get into something, they're great little speakers. But then, you know, slowly, if you can start bumping up, you really do, like Diego was saying, you kind of fill in those gaps and you start listening to your stuff on bigger and better speakers and all, basically what you're buying is like clarity. You're buying, you're really getting to see what you're recording and what you're doing.
Scott, is there a pushback about DSP?
It wasn't a pushback. It took years for people to get their arms around it. Well, because you're showing people that in their rooms that they've used sometimes very successfully, that you might have bass build up at 180 hertz, 10 dB. Mm. No, your software is wrong. Well, the Finns spent about 3 years developing that software, and I fully believe that. And, you know, you know what your ears are used to. Just as Rob said, he's had great success with his 1031s, and you know what it sounds like, right or wrong. You know what's right, and you know where the speaker is pushing it. And I know, let's say at 200 hertz, I got to pull down. But it was getting people to feel comfortable that the DSP really is doing what it's supposed to do, and here's what the sound is, what it's supposed to sound like. And I must have done this 50, 60 times. I would tell people, the close was, okay, we're going to make two mixes on a rhythm section. We're going to make it with DSP, and we're going to use whatever your other speakers are, and we're going to go to your car and listen to it and hear how it translates. Because we all know better or worse what our cars sound like.
Right.
And you can hear how the pocket really locks in there, especially with the DSP. Because now, if you have, let's say, the whole point is if you've got in a small room, and if you don't mind, if I can just go into this for a second.
Sure.
Let's say you have a second bedroom. second bedroom is 10 by 12. Well, an open E on a bass guitar is 41 hertz, and it's 32 feet long. Mm. 32-foot sine wave in a 10-foot room is going to be a lot of bass buildup. That's fake bass. It's Genelec's thought process that you want to be able to make your mixing decisions on the music rather than the bass buildup in your room. So that is the part that was hard for a lot of people to wrap their arms around.
So, okay, so the music people, I think, could feel this, but how about broadcast and everything other than music? How do they feel about it?
Broadcast was and remote trucks were embraced it much easier, especially remote trucks where it's a very small space and they needed all the help that they can get.
Right.
They got it very quickly. Broadcasters, I mean, Fox has got 5.1 DSP system somewhere around there in Beverly Hills. They get it because they know it has to be flat in there to translate everywhere else.
It's being broadcast. I see what you mean.
That's good to know.
You know, it's like saying, my room is not that great, but it's one of the first points of pride, having a great room.
And from an engineer's point of view, you know, when you hear about DSP, you don't think of correction. You think of EQing. You think it's like, oh, re-EQing my room. You know what I mean?
Well, please. Really, I mean, I know I had some issues with 1 kilohertz in my room, so I wouldn't mind that.
But, you know, there's some bad DSP out there, too.
No, so,
I mean, anybody that's been bit by a you know, once is very hesitant. Yeah.
And that's a smart person to do that. But the thing is, a lot of people also don't realize this doesn't negate the need for proper acoustics.
Right.
There's a lot of things that you can do setting it up properly.
Sure.
Making sure the speakers are, as Rob said earlier, in the right place to start off
with.
That's
true. Well, it's all this to say is Scott Genelex, just it's awesome.
Thank you.
It's, and it was hard to give them back.
I knew you had the two guys with billy clubs.
And just so you guys know, I mean, we're talking a lot about Genelex, but like for my own personal home studio, I use Adams S3As. So it's, you know, there are other good speakers that are out there, except, you know, Genelex changed my life, but that's just a small thing. So.
Are they going to buy them?
Yeah, we're going to get them. But, you know, nothing goes quick in a corporation.
They have an extra.
You know what? I've been, while I've been out of LA, I'm running around, I've been working in different studios in different cities. And I really miss my Genelex. Actually, at the last studio we just worked at in Austin, we got them to borrow a pair of 1031As, and it was the closest thing to being home again. It was pretty cool. And I do miss.
Well, you know, if I can help you, just you know how to find me. Give me a call.
I'll do that. I wish I had thought of that earlier.
You know, it's something's a de facto standard is when you go start listening to other speakers and they're always comparing them to Genelex, you know? And I find that all the time whenever I start, you know, demoing other speakers. And there were some weird speakers at AES this year. I don't know. Did you see the, was it Barefoot or Big Sky or Blue Sky? I don't know.
They Barefoot, were the, Barefoot was there. Barefoot.
Was that with the speakers that had those handles on it on the side?
Yeah.
They're like $20,000 or some ridiculous thing that's like, holy smokes.
I mean, the speaker's $500.
They have handles on the side so you have something to hold on to when you hear the price.
Exactly. I was going to say the handles are the actual expense.
But there you go,
the handles are an extra $10,000.
See, that baffles me that another company would spring up like that, thinking that there is a market for them and they can actually make some money doing this. I'm completely baffled.
No, I am too. Especially on that high-end monitor, because that's all like –
but probably
ATC, you know, that's kind of their market on that level. And, you know, because they're the only ones that can get away with
it. ATC, PMC.
Yeah, exactly.
When you see some of those are very expensive and extremely well-designed speakers for home systems, you know that there's a market for people that have cash to burn and they're looking for something that look different. So they make all these weird shapes and stuff. So probably, you know, there's some studio owners that they somehow buy it into this thing.
You're right about, I agree, in the consumer world, fashion, the shape, I mean, like B&W, and they've got some great stuff.
Bang looking with.
Yeah, actually.
Bauer and Wilkins.
Yeah.
But in a studio, it's a tool, just like got
I mean, the B&W sounds great. We use them at CES with DTS. They sounded great in the for the demos. But then, you know, I've seen some of these speakers with gigantic glass cones and stuff like that.
I know.
They look beautiful, but you're like, because I'm, you know, from a sound designer perspective, I glass speakers?
I'm
not sure.
What's that going to sound like?
Exactly.
It's going to sound like the speaker from MASH that Radar O'Reilly used to talk on, you know?
It's great as a processing device, but not really as a speaker, you know?
Yeah. No, I'm with you on that. You look at some of the Orb ones and they're not cheap.
No, they're expensive.
Having said that, you know, Rob and myself have a mutual friend that has a home stereo that is, let's just say, amazing. I mean, just and he has speakers, although they're not crazy. They are ginormous, and they have a subwoofer, a woofer column, and a tweeter column, plus a subwoofer, and cables that are like quarter inch.
Oh my god,
you know,
the cables.
Quarter thing.
Let's not get into cables.
No, I know.
That's
all
another show.
Exactly.
And $3,000 for the AC cable, right?
Exactly. But when you play them, it's music unlike anything you've ever heard before.
No, of course.
You can hear into it. I mean, that's all I can say is it's just
– No, I'm not saying that there's no benefits because when you hear to some of those systems
– But they're paying for it. It's not cheap.
Exactly.
It's not
cheap.
Right, Rob? You know.
Absolutely. But you know what the funny part to me is? Like all these aficionados who get this stuff at home – they always say they buy these speakers because they want to hear the way it was intended in the studio. Meanwhile, they're buying speakers that no studio has anywhere.
Exactly.
If most people, if you want to hear the way the stuff was intended in the studio, buy some NS10s and save a ton of money.
And put a piece of paper on the woofer to see how much it moves.
Well, you know, nothing kills a conversation with an audiophile faster than when you start talking and they ask you what you do. And you go, oh, I'm an audio mixer. And it just, you know, just shut down, you know, because it's like, because exactly what Rob's saying.
Yeah.
We're working on speakers that are, you know, a tenth of the
price. But
I
think that the whole idea behind the listening experience is different because in a studio, you got to get it done. In a home studio, you enjoy it. Even if the dimensions of listening are not really the same, you just enjoy the experience.
Well,
and it's like going to an amusement park. It's not a real airplane.
It's so, but
you still
enjoy
the ride.
That's the reason that Bose is so successful, actually.
Well, it's funny that you say that, Rob, because I was a producer friend of mine was asking me about headphones. Mm-hmm. And I said, there are just a lot of headphones out there, and there's just a bunch of different ones. And there was another audio friend who was there. And I know he was probably expecting me to say stuff about getting a flat. You know,
right.
You know, you want to get it accurate, yada yada yada.
Dr. Beats.
And I, she asked me with the one that I use, and I use Bose because they're not flat. They have a nice little kick in the bass, and they're a very pleasant consumer sounding experience. I mean, if anybody wants to get, and they're kind of like pseudo high end, you know, they have a feel of like you're buying something more than what they really are. But, you know, you just go with a Bose, you know, headphones for $150 and they sound good. And I think I really surprised them that I wasn't, you know, I wasn't going for accuracy and I wasn't going for flatness.
Yeah, but then you say, but at home, I use $3,000 cables.
To feed your headphones.
I have a coach this big.
Did Genelec ever make headphones? Or
no.
Did you ever look into it?
I don't know.
Interesting. All right. Well, we will we'll wrap that up. And like I said, Scott, thank you so much for setting up that demo. And you have a believer in me.
And thank you for inviting me here.
Before we go, I wanted to talk to Diego because Diego,
I've been hiding in my back cave. No, the thing is, I've been building these instruments,
right?
And one day I built this instrument from a branch that I found on the street, and it came out very nice. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to do a piece of music with it, as I did before with the Xperi bass and other things. But then I thought, well, I have some other instruments that I haven't used before. What if I build a few more and I try to put it together as an orchestra? So I built a few more instruments, and I gave myself this stupid task of doing it because once I started, I wanted to get it done, but it was very difficult because first of all, I just built these things, so I don't really know exactly how to play them. So I have to figure out first what I'm going to do. So I tried to create a mock-up on the keyboard about the piece that I wanted to play, but that approach didn't work because I can't really translate what I can play on a keyboard on an instrument that I just built first, and second, that doesn't really have the finesse of a actual, you know, not an actual instrument because everything is an actual instrument.
Right.
But
at least in your world.
Exactly. But a properly finished instrument.
Right.
But anyway, at some point, I just, you know, I almost gave up, but then I started playing something on the Xperi bass, which is probably the instrument that inspires me the most. And then from there, I came up with the rest of the ideas, you know, and I created this piece of music by playing each part. And at some point, I needed something for the melody, so I built the Xperi violin, you know.
Okay.
Yeah, because I was building while I was composing the music. I needed something for that part, and so it was a percussion, and then something for the melody, and so an instrument for that thing.
Interesting that you say that, because I was going to ask you if you had the instruments or if you built the instruments for the music, but it sounds like it was
It happens at the same time. Yeah. I mean, I was thinking, okay, what do I do here? Do I want to play another part on the Xperi bass? Maybe I just build an instrument for it. And the Xperi violin
didn't take me that long. It's the body of a violin plus the neck of an electric guitar. So it was very easy to play, and it's upright, like the Xperia bass.
Do you hear the sound that you're, for instance, on the melody in your head and what kind of instrument?
There's a circus going on in my head all day and night long, seriously. I dream about stuff, and I'm like, stop it! Just sleep! Yeah, no, but I do have a pretty clear idea of...
He's a musical Sybil.
of what I want to do. I mean, I've been building instruments for a while now, so... But still, what I like is the surprise. You know, once you build it for the first time and you go play it, you go, interesting. And then you figure out what you can do, which note sounds better than others, and the techniques. I tried, you know, with the chopsticks, with the bow.
Right.
I tried with, you know, that thing that you use to mix eggs inside?
Yeah, a beater.
The beater, okay. That on the strings. But it sounded like a mandolin. And it didn't really fit with the style of this piece of music that I've done, which one. Ended up being, I thought, okay, I'm going to do a piece of music, kind of light, nothing really dramatic. But then my real nature kicked in and it became progressively more and more aggressive and very dark and heavy at the end. So I said, you know what? That's going to be.
And what's the name of the piece?
It's called Custom Built Orchestra.
Yeah.
Because it's the name of the project and also the name of the piece. Yeah.
And if you Google it, you'll see it. It's on Vimeo also.
Yeah.
And it's also, if you go to Diego's website. Mm-hmm.
Which I actually
linked to it.
Redesigned.
I know, I saw that.
I mean, a friend of mine in Italy helped me.
It looks nice. The
whole. Simple, you know, I just wanted something simple. Cause,
but you get to the latest projects really quick. I like it. I think it's really cool.
Yeah. I mean, it's a work in progress. I still have to put some stuff in it, some pictures, but it's better than having a website in Flash that didn't even open. It was completely broken by the end.
Was it really?
Yeah, there were some components that just started freaking out. I couldn't even open on Safari. Or...
That was called Flash.
Yes. Yeah.
It was cool, though.
Yeah, looked thanks. Good.
Well, we'll be sure to check it out. We'll put a link on it on the podcast page. But, welcome back, and hopefully you'll stick around
for another
one.
I'm glad to be here, yeah. No, seriously, I was in a very, very – I was kind of pissed, actually, by the end. I was like, I have to make it now. Because after you build a dozen instruments, what do?
Yeah. I don't know. I've never built one. So.
No, but don't even start. Once you get into – I'm building another one right now.
Let me ask you a question on along the same lines, but I've been going online now and I'm starting to see a lot more like copycats of the stuff that you do. Have you seen any of the ones that are out
I've
there?
I've seen a couple of things. There are people that understand the concept and they actually make some nice things.
Right.
Some other people that, the principle behind my work is that if I say I'm making music from a plate, I want to hear that it's a plate.
Right.
So I'm not really applying too much processing on it. The people that I understand this, they do something along that line and it's nice. Some other people, they take an object and they put so much processing on it that you could use exactly anything that would sound exactly the same.
That's true.
And that's pointless to me.
Yeah.
Because... What's the point?
Yeah, exactly. No, I get it. I was just curious because
but I'm happy to see that. And besides, it's not like I invented the approach. Yeah. I'm just pushing it to
a different level.
A different level, you know.
Well, and your instruments, I think, are more along the lines of instruments. It's not like stomp that's very environmental without the instrument.
But stomp,
thing.
The stomp is a show, you know.
Right.
You have the fun and the humor of all the players together. My videos, and I think this is the reason why they don't really go viral, it's because at the end of the day, it's still a musical project where I am exploring something.
Yeah,
it's not there really isn't too much production value in the video. It's nice, but it's not like wow, I'm renting a theater.
Well, you go a couple hundred thousand though. That's kind of viral to me.
I know, but I'm not going to the million and a half views or 2 million. I don't know because you know what's funny? I was in London at the Wired conference because they invited me to speak there and I met Gautier.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And so I went to say hi to him And I said, hey, I just want to say hi. And he goes, well, I know you. No, I know you much better. But in fact, he was telling me about my videos. And he had a chance. So what is surprising me, what surprises me is that musicians that are into that kind of approach, yeah, like multi-instrumentalists, they have seen my videos.
Right.
And that's the thing I like. Because, you know, even if it's a small viewership, it's a very focused viewership.
Right.
And it was kind of fun, you know. Yeah.
That is cool.
Yeah.
That is cool. Ask him next time you meet him, how's he going to do it on his follow-up?
No, we are in touch now. We're mailing back and forth. He's a very nice guy. And we had a chance to talk about...
I like his music.
Yeah, yeah.
Except that one song. Just... got overplayed.
It was his fault.
I know. It's not, hey, yeah, that's what you want to happen, you know?
Well, you know, it's also the rest of his albums are, they're really cool. I mean, oh, the videos, they're hilarious. There's one,
the rest of that album.
Pants down on the toilet. I mean, it's kind of funny the way the video.
The last four songs on that album, mm-hmm, it's phenomenal. It's a great boom, boom, boom.
You know, there's the thing that I like about what he does is that he has some very textural, yeah, elements,
yeah,
and segments in his pieces of music. So you have, yeah, of course, the rhythm and the groovy part,
right,
and then he goes into this very, yeah, abstract thing, which is the kind of thing I like doing, yeah, too.
That the last song on his record is such an awesome ballad. It's really has this almost plotting type of rhythm.
Bronte, I think it's called.
Yeah, yeah. And it's just...
We will be...
Exactly.
Be,
yeah,
yeah, awesome. With the voices.
It has an anthem feel, and yeah, it works really well.
Anyway. Yeah.
All right, well, I'm sure we're going long, so we're going to have to wrap this up. But before we go, let me just ask you really quick. Rob, you working on anything fun and exciting that you can talk about?
Let me think. Well, just to give you an idea of what my days have been like while I've been away, today was 16 hours at the office in Philly,
wow,
working on my sort of semi-secret project. But then also at my studio, we were mastering and mixing some music for a video game with Scott Gershon's company.
Ah.
And actually, if you've been seeing, I look a little distracted on, yes, the Skype, it's because I have a second machine here where I'm actually delivering all the mixes from the studio in LA over another remote connection while we're talking, because it's going to take about 4 hours. I'm trying to multitask here. So things have not been boring, and I'm still producing a music project in Austin that I think I've talked a little bit about, but I'll be able to talk more about it when it actually gets released. But we should have a single out. December 2nd is what we're actually aiming for. Oh, so I'm going to be able to start, right, talking, great, about that soon. And it's fun recording in Austin. It's a very different vibe down there, and
hey,
everybody's
are you
very nice.
Bill?
What's that?
Bill Burgess. Are you seeing him?
Yeah, Bill Burgess is down there.
I haven't seen him. I haven't seen anyone. Oh, okay. Really under the gun. Although this past weekend was the Grand Prix in Austin, so I got to see several hundred thousand other people who don't actually belong there like I don't.
Maybe Bill was there.
But it's a fun town, and my sister lives there, so I've gotten to spend some time with her. It's been really nice, but I haven't gotten to see Bill yet. I'll look him up on one of these trips. To give you an idea, I was in Austin twice in the last week. I've gone back and forth twice in, wow, 1 week, and it's going to be that way for a little while longer. So I'll see Bill on one of those trips.
Nice. Wow. Say hi to him.
I will, definitely.
Say we love Logic.
I will go there specifically to tell him that.
You never stop fighting. Never, ever.
Tigo, are you working on anything new?
Well, I for some reason, I started building another instrument, because what I have in mind now, I'd like to build, because I've been exploring doing things live,
right,
with real-time sound design,
right,
but I want to build a better rig, also because I'm finding a lot of cool apps on the iPad, and I just want to find a way to integrate everything together, so somehow avoiding having too much latency inside Ableton Live, you know,
gotcha,
avoiding to overkill that application.
Right.
So I'm kind of sketching down ideas, and I'm sure out of that I'll be able to create some other music and things. Yeah.
Awesome. Bobby, how about yourself, sir?
I haven't been too busy. I just came back from Turkey. I gave the keynote address at the ATMM conference over there.
Wow.
And then I spoke at SAE, and I spoke at AES on, wow, social media for musicians and engineers. And let's see, a new book, the what's it called? The audio mix audio mixing boot camp just came out, and two new videos for Lynda.com. Recording techniques. One is recording audio recording techniques, and the other one is mixing or mastering for iTunes.
Wow!
And there's probably something else that I can't think of right now.
Wow! So you haven't been too busy?
No,
not really.
I need to check out. I need to check out those Lynda.com courses.
Yeah,
there's some great stuff on there.
They sound
about
really
you, Mike?
Cool.
Besides playing with Genelex all day long now.
Genelex, doing some mixing, have my own little project that's going to be coming out that I talked about last podcast that I'll talk about in a future podcast.
In the 0.5 and, podcast, you mean?
And, no, actually 124, okay. The one that we're going to post that we haven't posted yet.
Okay.
But I will say really quick, I got an iPad mini. Best iPad ever. Seriously, if you guys out there and – you know me, I'm a tech junkie, but the thing about the iPad mini is it's just as good as an iPad 2, but it's smaller, and that size really makes a difference.
The weight makes a difference,
yeah,
I think. Yeah.
The fact that you're on iOS and you can still use all those great synths and you can still use all those great audio apps that I use.
I want to try it.
And then, but it's smaller, and it's not as small as the 7-inch like Nexus or the other ones. You really can't, you know, hold it, you know, if you have small hands in one hand, but it's so tiny. It's very easy to move in and out, and depending on how your apps are, like I have a Folio for it, and it's better than an iPhone for me because the iPhone 5, and you know, it's a phone. It's a great thing to take with you, but sometimes you need a little bit more real estate, and you just want to be able to do stuff, and you can work on it. I see it, Rob.
Okay, so I need to make an announcement. As the guy who had the oldest cell phone in the world.
Yes, you did.
I did. It was a Verizon XV6700, which translates to old. It was an old pocket PC Windows phone. I am holding up in front of the Skype camera my iPhone 5,
woo!
Which,
nice.
Which I will now probably keep until they come out with the iPhone 17. I change phones about once every 7 years, but Mike, I finally caved to the pressure.
You know what? I'm so proud of you. I'm so
Thank
proud.
You.
I've got a little tear. Now what you got to do is, along with that, what is really good is a iPad mini to accompany.
Hey, question. Did you try applications that you used also on the regular size?
Oh, yeah. All my apps are.
How does it feel?
It feels better.
For example, since do you have like the Animoog or something?
Yeah,
like
I got Animoog.
And you don't really feel like it's too tiny?
It's the exact. Yeah.
I want to try
the
that.
The other thing, too, is like a lot of times I'll do most of the multi-touch stuff. Mm-hmm. So I won't emulate a real keyboard like on Xsynth and some of the other ones.
You know what, the way I said Animoog, there's going to be people, oh, it's not Animoog, it's Animoog. Forgive me.
Anyway, it's really good. If you do a lot of traveling, and because sometimes the big iPads are, you know, they're a little big. I mean, it's – I know that seems hard to say because
as compared to a brick, yeah. Yes.
but it's for me, it's all about being lean and mean, and the less bulk I can take with me, the better it is for me. And I don't know. There's something about going to a meeting and you open up a small little folio like this and you're taking notes on it. That's a lot less cumbersome than taking a bigger iPad out, you know. And the fact that you're in the iOS universe just opens up all those apps. So I just wanted to give that a plug, not for anything
You have so drunk the Kool-Aid.
I have.
It's just unbelievable.
No, but it's – I'm not a total Apple fanboy.
What?
I'm not. I know. They're going to kill
the
towers.
Are you kidding me? I hear a news. Like, I'm here. I see the product. Come on.
I've got Android tablets, and I've got PCs that I work on too. So
yeah, I use them as a doorstep.
No. I know, but this is a great size for what it is.
Nice.
Anyhow,
well, if you need an old pocket PC phone, I know a guy who's got a good deal.
Yes. A good deal.
Actually, you had that same phone, but it was 7 years ago. I remember when you had that phone.
It was longer than that, buddy. It was longer than that.
Well, the way I was describing it to people is I think I bought my last phone that I used up until a week ago. I think I bought it about 4 years before the iPhone 1 came out. Oh, that gives you an idea.
Yeah. No, it was...
You can still use it when you go overseas and just get a new SIM card for it while you're over there. And
I don't even think it had a SIM card because it was Verizon. I think it is absolutely as useless as it can possibly be. Nice. And the reason I switched is because the battery would last just long enough to tell people I didn't have time to talk because the battery was going to go.
Hey, but you're not a phone talker anyhow. So.
But I'm grateful to Skype that I was able to be there tonight. Skype is pretty cool.
That is cool. Scott, anything on the horizon from Genelec or anything?
Genelec will be introducing at the NAMM show some new products.
Nice.
And more new products at future shows. There's a bunch of things that are working their way out, and Genelec is always cooking up and devising new things.
Nice.
And what was the big push, just to recap, what was the big push at AES for Genelec? Was there a specific new push, or was it?
No, we had a new small subwoofer, but that's really – that it's kind of like an intermediate product. The NAMM show and the NEB are going to be very big for us.
Intermediate meaning for a small room or in terms of the range?
It's an expensive product cycle. It's kind of like an intermediate product.
Oh,
it's
going to
fill a niche for us.
All right. Well, hey, if you have any comments or questions, you can reach us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com. That's audio@nowcastnetwork.com. And I will try to check that email. I say that because sometimes it goes.
We're handling
days.
Those five people really well now.
We've got seven people.
Whoa!
Eight now. I just joined.
And I just want to let you guys know, we haven't been putting out a lot of podcasts because everybody's been really busy. It seems like everybody had a really busy fall. We're kind of ramping up for a pretty good we'll probably do one, maybe two more podcasts before the end of the year. But starting the new year, there's some really good shows that we're planning that are going to be coming down the pipe with some really cool guests. And that's all I'm going to say to plug that. But it'll be really good. If you have any comments or questions, you can reach us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com. That's audio@nowcastnetwork.com. And I will try to check that email. And you can also reach us on Facebook at facebook.com/audionowcast. For myself and from all the guys, thanks for listening. Scott, thank you for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
And we'll catch you next time. See ya.
Woo! See ya.
Listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by API and Westwave Audio. The Audio Nowcast is hosted by Mike Rodriguez and uses AFEX's 230 Master Channel Voice Processor. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.